Welcome to this episode of the Erasing Shame Podcast. I'm your co-host, DJ Chuang. And on this episode, I'm talking with Steve Hong. How are you?
Doing fine, thank you.
And Steve Hong is based in San Francisco, and he's given a lot of thought to the topic of shame. And he lives a very embodied life, which means being local or hypo-local, builds a lot of deep relationships. And we're going to have a conversation about what he's discovered and excavated about shame. How does that sound?
Sounds good. I look forward to it.
Now, the name of this podcast is Erasing Shame. So I'd love to tease out a bit more of how you came to the term excavating shame. And before you, as you do that, you might share a little bit about your background on how you got to where you are.
Those are two different threads. Bit of bio. Born and raised in San Francisco, studied engineering, and then went into ministry. I found that a lot of Asian American ministers followed a similar path. Transitioning from engineering to ministry brought a lot of shame to my family. That was the biggest obstacle, threshold, because there were expectations on me, particularly from my father, to do what was most honorable. And that did not include going into ministry, right? You know, was on staff with Campus Crusade for Christ, later named CRU. I pastored a couple of churches. But I'll say this, the thing that brought the most shame was refinishing floors, joining a company of missionaries. They started a secular company because they wanted to, Jeremiah chapter 29, they wanted to seek the shalom of San Francisco in the most incarnational way possible. So they started a secular company, which we've since been recognized by the city and, you know, gotten some awards. But my dad didn't care about that. The fact that I was a blue collar worker, scrubbing floors and serving other people, brought greater shame. He couldn't even look at me in the eye. To your second question, actually your first question, erasing shame. You know, the gospel, when I read the gospels, it's pretty simple. Jesus died for our shame. He, all the parables of Jesus, I see, where, especially when he encounters people, he invites people in their shame and elevates them to places of honor. When I think of the Hall of Fame, as it's commonly called in Hebrews chapter 11, you can pretty much trace from Adam to Noah to Abraham to the barren women, to the shepherds, to pretty much everyone who's marginalized, God reverses our shame. And so I appreciate your term too, erasing shame, because at the cross, that shame is erased. But the reason I have gravitated towards terms like reversing our shame, because the shame is dynamically turned around unto honor. When God saw his son be baptized and pronounced belovedness. Jesus, when he was baptized, especially on the cross highlights all the ways we've derived our honor from. And it's typically, you know, disassociated, meaning it's short-sighted. It comes out empty. Ultimate honor comes from being invited into the family of God. And that's why our name is called, our nonprofit name is called Kingdom Rice. Rice denotes all the marginalized communities and populations, the very people that I feel are centered in the Holy Scriptures, and that they have direct access. They are invited to that banqueting table of the kingdom, where the King, the Father, as in the prodigal son, the compassionate father, invites us to his banqueting table. And so, so shame gets turned onto honor. And so is the shame erased? Yeah, I could say that. It's also reversed and it's turned around onto honor.
How about the word replace? Why not just replace shame with honor?
Yeah, you know, these are all ideas. There's a trajectory where we start at a lower status and God literally lifts us up to a higher plane. So however you want to articulate that, the word, the picture is that we're actually elevated. So is it replaced? Yeah, you could say so. Is it erased? I mean, I think we tend to look at words and concepts atomistically, but if you widen the lens, the whole picture is that dynamic where we are elevated to a place and invited into a space that presents utmost honor, utmost dignity.
Okay, elevated fits well with what you've described so far. You said a lot in just a few minutes, and how doing blue collar work was shameful to your family. And we've yet to describe or define the word shame. And I don't know if you have a good definition that can help us to see why doing blue collar work might be perceived shameful when there's plenty of people that do blue collar work and it's meaningful and we need people to do that.
Right, right. I mean, to work backwards, yes, in God's kingdom, any work we do where God is our boss can be seen with utmost dignity. There are authors like Henry Nouwen, Brother Lawrence, who that speak to that. In my Asian culture, you know, my family, I hate to admit it, it's true, a lot of Asians, but we've subscribed to the model minority myth, a myth that elevates us based on a false narrative that our worth and identity is based on income and having jobs that tend to surround engineering or law or medical fields. The definition of shame, I don't know if this comes from Brené Brown or whoever, other popular authors, but in the most simplest terms, shame identifies what's wrong with us. There's something wrong with me, versus commonly guilt is something wrong that I've done. Mm-hmm. And of course, you can turn to the beginnings in Genesis chapter 3, when Adam, you know, disobeyed God. He felt guilt, he felt shame, and, you know, sewed fig leaves together, and experienced fear too. You know, he was afraid and hid from God. And we see a reconciling of all of those and more throughout the Gospels.
Well, now that you mentioned Genesis 3, Dr. Kirk Thompson's done some neuroscience and study about shame, and he describes how shame causes us to hide.
Oh, yes.
Whereas guilt prompts us to move towards someone in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a journal article. So this is going to be a more of a think piece conversation. So there's a journal article that studied in the Chinese language, there's 113 terms related to shame. So shame is not just a model minority dynamic. Right. It is embedded, baked, seeped, and simmered into our Chinese culture and how that Confucian culture has affected many Asian cultures as well. So I know you're doing training for Asian American leaders and those who work with Asian and Asian Americans with some of the shame dynamics. And I noticed you also use a word excavating. So
yes.
Describe how that helps us de-escalate or, you know, take the shame dynamic, take the power away from shame so that we can receive and live in the honor God bestows upon us.
Yeah, yeah. Before we go there, let me clean up one thing. Yes, I train Asian leaders in Asia and here, but we go beyond that because shame is not just an Asian dynamic. True, it has is ensconced in Confucian values and more. But it's worthy to point out that shame has been a part of North American culture, Western culture, for a long time. You think about the military, you think about sports teams. Jackson Wu, who's now Brad Vaughn, writes a lot about that in his writings. Chris Flanders, who edited a book I contributed to, co-editor to be specific, says it this way, that shame honor culture is found in every culture. It's just a matter of where you look. And surely with social media, shame culture, if you will, is all upon us. Brené Brown says that shame is today a silent epidemic. It affects everybody. Also, she says, but we don't talk about it enough. So how do we name the shame? How do you turn it around? Well, you've got to name it. And how do you name it? Well, all cultures, especially Asian culture, as you pointed out, DJ, it's a part of our narrative. And so I give space in our training for people to name this narrative. Now, some of that narrative is painful or traumatic. So I use the power, I use the scriptures, really. I mean, you look at Lamentations, there's a recent book by Sung Chang Ra, Prophetic Lament, and an old book, Walt Kaiser, I believe, that makes the point that, you know, you can come in from the side, in other words, third person, and describe this pain, or use third person narratives or historical narratives. So that's what we do. We take narratives so that we can begin to describe, and then we can find however much of this shame narrative we can, we give points of attachment so that we can begin to name the shame that we've experienced. For many Asians, of course, that's coming over, immigrating to this country. For my African-American friends, you can't even use the word immigration because of the slave trade. So I put people together based on the contours of their narrative so we can excavate. And so the excavate, just like you think of paleontology, is something that you need to do very carefully. And as you do that, you discover treasures. And we don't advertise safe environments because when if you advertise it, there's always someone unsafe typically. But as much as we can, we use structures that I learned from people who have written a lot about lament, people who have, you know, exegeted a lot regarding the lament genres of the Psalms, you know, just a huge scripture that we have regarding lament and using wisdom to help us to excavate stories of shame and to find our own story. So we can begin to see it, name it, describe it, and then we can offer, well, here's a narrative that we can choose to subscribe to. And that is a narrative of honor, a narrative of invitation.
Well, good. Thanks for giving us that quick overview or in-depth insider look at that overview. And like you said, the issue of shame is a human story. It goes all the way back to Genesis 3. So it's in every culture. It just looks different in different places. It has different flavors and different accents.
Right.
In different cultures. One group of missiologists have researched and estimate 2/3 of the world run on the honor shame operating system. And so it's a global thing, and the social media has brought out certain dynamics there. And shame isn't just a painful feeling we feel; it is also something we could weaponize and do to other people. It can also describe the brokenness in our relationship with one another, or even with ourselves. It's a huge topic, and that's what we've discovered as we talk about it here on the Erasing Shame podcast.
Not only is it huge, it is, I mean, synonymously saying it is relevant, it is timely. Let me say something arguably prophetic. The Christian missionary movement, to some degree, is still stuck on a guilt-based only or penal substitution atonement only way of presenting the gospel, one that guilt trips people. And what you just said, that a majority of the world, and especially with the globalization of world dynamics, author Ray Bakke, who just passed away a couple of years ago or last year, said that urbanization and Asianization, in other words, the influx of Asian culture, has pushed this even more. You just think about how popular Korean pop music and foods, and you know, you and I live in very Asian enclaves, and so we get this, but it's this is something that is not a marginalized topic in seminary, and Christian missionary circles, I fear, DJ, that what you and I are calling normative, pervasive, relevant for all, is still treated marginally. And that's why I started a nonprofit to center these things and to build into leaders. By the way, I haven't even introduced the name of our nonprofit, but I suppose you asked me. I just planted that one.
Well, you mentioned it at the beginning and you mentioned it now, Kingdom Rice. And how long have you been running Kingdom Rice?
As a nonprofit since 2017, as a nonprofit, the word rice basically means we center the marginalized communities, as I believe Jesus, God of heaven, centers these communities from Old Testament to New Testament. And that kingdom rice, kingdom as the adjective, means you don't have to be white to be accepted and to be invited into the kingdom. So it centers marginalized Black, Indigenous, people of color theologies, of which honor shame theology, theologies of reciprocation, theologies of place. In other words, place is important. Where you come from is important. Your culture is important. You don't have to give that up and to be Western or white to be accepted into the kingdom of God.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for doing what you're doing. And we've spent most of our time so far talking about the concept of shame and why it's important. We want to equip ministry leaders, and we'll certainly add a link in the show notes to Kingdom Rice website and your email newsletter. Now, many of our listeners are young adults, and they're just normal people, and they might get lost in some of the academic framework. So what word of encouragement would you have with someone who is experiencing shame, which is pretty much everybody, but you know.
Well, one, just a simple truth that just to receive, I mean, if there's one thing that I would want to take home, is that God is inviting you to a place of belonging. That so much of Christian preaching, which advocates for, you know, good measure to change our behavior, essentially, I mean, at worst, is to change our behavior, but you can't change the feelings of shame and this framework of having good behavior until we're in an environment where you actually are attached and loved and belong, regardless of how little or how deep you feel your shame is, or your guilt is, or your fear, or your purity, how clean you feel, regardless of how dirty or clean you feel your background is. It's really, really important to find, be it through a church or spiritual community, because they come in all sizes and forms, Zoom, I don't care what it is, but you need to be in places that reflect a place where God is experienced through this invitation. And that's the environment where we can begin to work out all the things that separate us from God, be it whatever degrees of shame, whatever degrees of guilt, whatever degrees of fear, whatever degrees of feeling dirty or impure. And then in those spaces, we can actually, as it says in Romans, work out the members of our body. We can name old habits, and we won't be judged by them. We can repurpose them for righteousness and for good. And sometimes we have it backwards. Whenever we're in a community that expects behavioral change first, then frankly, I believe that will not be long-lasting change. Colossians 3 comes to mind. The joke in the NIV is titled Rules for Holy Living, but the whole point is rules don't work. When God called us to his own and called us to his banqueting table, identity gets changed first. And lastly, the most prophetic word I'll say is, if all this is true, as you look at the scriptures, then there's really no waging war within ourselves. There's no waging war between the flesh and the spirit, or the sinful nature, as the NIV used to say. That's a very individualistic, psychologized way of working things out. I don't believe that's scriptural at all. And actually, the NIV, that's why they changed back the terms to flesh. And you can look into Gordon Fee and the guy who edited the NIV. Brad Vaughn on the Patheos website has a new article about this. Ben Shin from Tabit has some sermons from 20 years ago about this. So it's floating. It's been floating around evangelical circles for a long time. All that to say, there's no room for victim mentality. That we are simply that we are victim to our past history. That's not to say that you won't always that the wounds that we carry won't sting, but we can surely take the sting out of our wounds in a place where we are accepted, a place where we call home. And that's why last thing I'm going to say is, especially in Asian places, the gospel usually starts with belonging before any kind of behavioral change.
Well, I think that's true for Asians as well as non-Asians.
Right.
And what you said unconsciously or intentionally was actually the subtitle of my webpage back in 1999, that I've been longing to find a place called home.
Yes.
And that sounds right. That resonates for me, that if I or if someone can find a place where they can belong, where they can be accepted for who they are, regardless of their background or what they've done or what they look like, that begins their journey of renewal and honor and coming out of that shame that causes us to hide. But you and I have lived life long enough to know that a place like that is very hard to find.
Yes.
Now, you live in San Francisco, so you know, I'll add a link to Kingdom Rice in the show notes so someone could reach out to you and say, could we meet up for coffee or tea and begin experiencing some of that acceptance? Because it's not something you can just read from a book. You really need to experience that in relationship with a person or a group of people.
Right.
So what else can people do that don't live in San Francisco?
Well, let me frame it this way. If you go to our website, kingdomrise.org, the first two, I'll just read it because I got it right in front of me. Okay. First thing it'll say is empathy for all neighbors through BIPOC stories. So that doesn't directly address DJ's inquiry, but it does summarize really the way I read the book of Acts. The work of the Holy Spirit enables us to empathize with all neighbors, especially neighbors we could not even imagine. And that's why we're in San Francisco, because we have all kinds of neighbors that we simply could not imagine relating to. Those who live on the other side of the tracks, those who threaten our well-being, those who are reported on in the news. But that's exactly what I see in the book of Acts. So what can we do? So the other two big words you see on my website is imagine and embody. So the first word, imagine, if you were to come to San Francisco, or if you go to our website, you see videos of excursions and immersions into different neighborhoods of San Francisco, where, you know, neighborhoods like Chinatown, my favorite, or New Chinatown, the first place where Asians could live without, this is getting too deep. I have to finish the sentence now. A neighborhood where Asians could live without making the buildings look orientalized. In other words, without needing to make buildings look like how white man wants the buildings to look. And so we take seminary students, church groups, all kinds of people. I've brought thousands of people through these neighborhoods, and I've written about them. We have an iPhone app on the website. We have virtual immersions with pictures provided by award-winning author Kathy Chin Leong in her recent book, Chinatown, which I also contributed to. So I'm naming these so we can put those in the show notes as well too. So imagine wherever you grew up, and begin to name how, begin to imagine how could God bring beauty in that place, and also name the negative effects too. As much as they're able to, find resources, articles that will help you to just tell your own story, where you came from, how you were shaped. And if you want to go a little bit more specific, how did you learn to love? How were you shaped to love? To borrow from Dallas Willard's book, Divine Conspiracy, I think it was book of the year 20 years ago. How were we discipled? How did we learn to deal with trials? Because how could you possibly deal with shame? And for that matter, how could you possibly be discipled by the Lord if we can't name how we've been taught, essentially naming past masters, naming past lords? And to excavate means to name both the beauty. Yeah, my parents tried their best, immigrant parents, and they brought provision to the table every day in the form of rice. And that's good. But maybe there's a shadow side, but that love was conditioned upon good grades, et cetera, typical Asian American story. And as we do that, we will find ourselves able to honor our own story, honor the story of our parents, as some of you know, that comes with a promise, and to honor the stories of people that are thoroughly unlike us. And we'll end up being or growing to be a kind of person that can make space for other people and other stories, no longer forcing people, well, let me back up, no longer forcing ourselves to acquiesce who we are in a white America, but we could be fully ourselves. And making space for other people, not to a white God, but to a God that creates a place, in as much as the word salvation denotes a roomy place, an invitation to a place where you could be yourself. And in so doing, again, a place where that shame can begin to be reversed, and all the habits, all the bodily habits that we've used to escape reality, escape ourselves, can begin to loosen up, and we can begin to see transformation that starts with a new identity.
Wow, you have given us a lot of meat to chew on, so thank you very much for doing that. Thank you for...
Hopefully that's not too much and not too convoluted.
Well, it's not convoluted. It's definitely dense. So I would call it meaty. And well, it's like chewing on good meat.
We offer a 6-week course that, and even that's just the beginning.
Yeah.
But it's all surrounding the words imagine. And I'm working, one of our websites, which I'll send to you, has resources like just book-wise. There's an educational Great. Piece for sure.
Okay.
But there has to be a social piece, connection, yes. online,
All right.
in person.
Good. Well, this is the invitation. So be sure to check the show notes at erasingshame.com. We'll connect you with all the opportunities that Kingdom Rice offers. And I'll also mention another one that's freely available online called Subtle Asian Mental Health. It's a Facebook group with 61,000 members. Where people can share anonymously when they need care and support or have a question about the challenges of life when it comes to mental health or relationships or those things that affects us in areas of shame as Asian Americans. So I'll have a link in the show notes there as well. I'm a member, a board member of Asian Mental Health Collective. It's a non-faith space, but it is a brave space where people can begin naming some of those things, because that is very much the first step towards healing and reversing that shame. Well, Steve, do you have a final words, or we can wrap up?
Final words. This is an exciting time. It's been a painful time post-pandemic. AAPI hate. Some of you know Russell Jung, who says we've got to, not his words, my word, excavation, which is actually a word from my former board member, Nate Lee. He gets the credit. But we need to excavate the inherent biases by which we see people. At the end of the day, God's love for us and for our neighbors is why we do what we do. And I would certainly welcome any inquiries you may have. So you can contact us on our website. And I'd love, and I'd be honored to sojourn with you. So thanks for having me.
Thank you. Thank you, Steve. Thank you for continuing the conversations at Erasing Shame about Kingdom Rice, about excavating shame, and how God truly invites us to a home of belonging and reversing our shame with His honor. Thank you so much, Steve. Great talking with you.
Thank you, DJ. Appreciate it. Appreciate your work too.
Thank you for listening to the Erasing Shame podcast. Check out the show notes at erasingshame.com and subscribe to our email for updates. We would love to hear from you, so please add your comments at our website or on social. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or any podcast app, and you can also subscribe on YouTube or follow on Facebook. Please add a rating and review so we can reach more people with our message of health, hope, and compassion. This podcast is the digital outreach of Christian Asia Mental Health.